ladies and gentlemen, very, very warm welcome to tonight's event, which is in our the LSE European Institute's series of panel discussions with Britain and Europe, the next chapter. And there will be many more, which are already being announced on the LSE's website, the European Institute's website, so we hope that you'll come to as many of those as possible. Perhaps you've been to one or two of them already. Now, ladies and gentlemen, any lingering doubts that we may have had about this referendum that we've been taking for granted for about 5 years now, any lingering doubts have, of course, been finally and comprehensively dispelled. And we're now in the manageable territory of known knowns, I guess. There will be a referendum on Britain's EU membership. And wherever you are coming from on the EU issue, we can all agree, I hope, that the stakes both for Britain and for the EU as a whole are very high. So here at the LSE, we've got a lot of work to do, ourselves and with our many partners, over the next couple of years. Maybe only the next 18 months. Watch this space. Things seem to be moving rather quickly, as you all have seen at the moment. Now, we take very seriously our responsibility as an evidence-based social science institution, he says pompously, to help ensure that the national debate over the next few months, the next 18 months, however long it'll be, that debate should be as well informed as possible. Informed of the economic facts, the legal constraints and possibilities, the diplomatic scenarios, and practical politics, the wider global implications of a Brexit, and of course the constitutional implications for a kingdom that the Scots pronounced united only a few months ago, but whose story is quite clearly by no means concluded. Who would have predicted such an abrupt turn in the national plot? Now, of course, there is also the no small matter, good Democrats that we are, of course, of public opinion. Now, if all this sounds insufferably pompous, believe me when I say that the LSE cannot be the source of all wisdom as we weigh the costs and benefits of Britain's continued EU membership. With our own experts and analysts, some of them on the platform this evening, we will be recruiting partners for Britain's journey into uncharted waters. Those partners will have differing analyses and will be drawing a range of conclusions from them. And many of those partners, like the Centre for European Reform, represented here tonight by John Springford, have already been doing very high quality work on this subject, on the implications of a Brexit, and they're already beginning to share it with the wider public. Now, the LSE, as I've suggested, will be a hub for much of that analysis, as well as a generator of much research of our own on the future of Britain in Europe. Our discussion tonight, as I said, is the latest in the EI series of panel discussions on Britain and Europe, next chapter, and I hope you'll come to more of those. So some of the questions which I'm sure we'll be touching on tonight are, first of all, what will be David Cameron's ask? What will be his bid? What are the red lines that he needs to achieve? Then that leads us inexorably to the question of what are his chances of getting it, and we'll be looking at those closely. And of course, good Democrats that we are, we have to ask the question, what are the chances of the British people endorsing it? So we have really assembled some of the best expertise available to address those kind of subjects in a knowledgeable and thoughtful way. And I would like to then to start to introduce our panel, beginning with Professor Sarah Hobolt, who holds the Southern Chair in European Institutions in the LSE European Institute. And amongst her many areas of distinction as a scholar is the analysis of voting behaviour, public opinion, and behaviour, particularly in referendums, I might add. So I shall ask Sarah to share some of her thoughts first before we move on, and then open up, of course, into a general discussion. So Sarah, the floor is yours.
talk more about exactly what we'll be voting on in terms of the renegotiation, what David Cameron can and will and want to get in Brussels. But I think ultimately this will be a debate about and a campaign about membership of the EU. Certainly if the yes side or the inside plays it right, this will be about whether or not to stay in the European Union, really regardless of what the particular renegotiation is. And there seems to be already sort of quite a bit of complacency in different political circles. You know, now the opinion polls seem to suggest that the yes is in the lead and, you know, David Cameron won and everything will be fine and the public will obviously do exactly as the political elites will, you know, will tell them to. So this is just sort of a matter of getting it over with quickly and we can move on. Now, I want to urge a little bit of caution. Actually, I was at an event this Monday where the British, the Irish ambassador stood up and said, well, you know, I have been there and I've seen that referendums can be lost. And this was a referendum, several referendums, in fact, in Ireland, in one of the countries that, according to polls and so on, amongst the most Europhile. Now, in Britain, in contrast, of course, British public opinion is amongst the most Eurosceptic. It's also, you know, the public, and I'll show a few slides on this, showing that if you compare to other European countries, citizens in the United Kingdom are amongst those that think that perhaps, you know, in fact, being outside the European Union is not such a bad thing, and they might be better off. So if you think that, if you look at the referendums that have been on not only membership, but also treaty changes, and where often you've had a very united elite advocating to stay inside the European Union, yet you've had a majority in favor of rejecting a treaty change that could have led to something like that, perhaps complacency is not in order. And I'll show you a bit of why that's the case. And then I'll also argue why it can nevertheless potentially be one for an insider. So the reason why political elites should sort of take seriously this campaign, as they know that will, is that not only is there declining trust in the European Union, but Britain is also way below the EU average. I mean, depending on how you tend to measure Britain, you know, British citizens always come out as the most EU critical, the most anti-European, the most Eurosceptical, depending on how you want to look at it. But this question was particularly illuminating. Please tell me to what extent you agree or disagree with each of the following statements. Britain would face a better future outside the EU. And this was grounded back in spring 2014. But 45% at that point agreed that, yes, Britain would face a better future without the EU. And 36% said they wouldn't, and then 20% undecided. And then you might think, no, but I read some polls recently that says something different. So clearly people have changed their minds. Well, one thing that we know about opinion polling and referendums is that it's not so much that people change their mind as that they don't really have fully formed attitudes. This is not like I have voted for the Labour Party for the past 30 years. You know, it takes a little bit of persuasion to go and vote for David Cameron then, or vice versa. Most people do not have an opinion about this. They only have an opinion when they happen to be asked about pollsters. And that means that this campaign coming up will be, to a large extent, shaping people's views on Europe for the first time. So in that sense, there's all to play for. Now, we have this here showing that this was the grounds for some complacency, saying, well, there's a clear lead. But this could also evaporate. Again, this does not mean that these 45% that happen to be asked on a particular day, they're definitely going to turn up and say yes. And we have quite a lot of evidence showing that if you slightly change the question or you provide some kind of information in an experimental setting and so on, people give you an entirely different answer when it comes to attitudes towards Europe and staying in. Another thing that is often forgotten is that when people vote in referendums, it's not only about the question on the ballot. Often they will use it as an opportunity to sort of kick whoever is asking the question in the teeth. They'll use it as a protest, as an anti-establishment vote, and they might actually relish the fact if all the major parties come out in favor to say the opposite. Nonetheless, I think potentially, I think that the strength still lies with the inside or the yes side in this campaign. And that's because we also know from research on voting behavior in referendums that voters are very risk-averse and that there's a status quo bias. And unlike previous referendums that have had to do with, often had to do with extending, extending treaty powers, further integration, where people have said, oh, we reject that because we want the EU, but we don't want more of the EU, we want the EU, but we don't want more political integration. This is about, or this will potentially be framed as a question of in and out. Now, if people then say, go and say no, or go and vote for an exit, that is potentially risky. And there's more uncertainty associated with that than the status quo, regardless of what David Cameron negotiates. And the campaign, I think, is ultimately going to be centered, or the vote choice is going to be centered around this choice. How badly worse off is Britain going to be, not only at a personal level, but as a country, if they decide to exit the EU? Or what is the uncertainty about that? And here I think there will be a quite strong concerted effort by business communities and others to say this. And this is why the key reason why I think we've seen this shift in the polls from a majority to leave to a majority to stay in, which is also associated with the shift in the polls in terms of would Britain be better off or worse outside the EU. Back in October 2013, that was pretty much tied, and now people are getting increasingly concerned that, in fact, Britain will be worse off outside the EU. But, of course, a lot of things are going to be outside the control of the political elites or the and others campaigning to stay in. For example, what's happening to the Eurozone? A lot of unpleasant things could happen in the Eurozone over the next year to 16 months, and that will shape the campaign. So I'll end on a note that this referendum has not been won yet, and still all to play for. Thank you. Just to say these are the latest polls. So if you change the question slightly, from either direction you see huge differences in who wants to stay in. Thank you.
Thank you. That was extremely informative and illuminating, Sarah. Thank you so much. And I'd now like to call Professor Simon Hicks, who's the head of the Department of Government here at the LSE, and Professor of European and Comparative Politics, which is a nice title to rejoice under. And Simon is going to share some of his considerable wisdom on matters European with us now, no doubt addressing the nature, the content of the Cameron ask, as I put it, and the possibility, the likelihood of him getting it.
Thank you, Maurice, and thank you all for coming. I'm going to say a few things about what does Cameron want, then say a few things about how soon could he get it and what could he get. And then I'll finish off with some thoughts about if we do vote to stay, what happens next? Which I think also should be part of the conversation, just to make sure we don't end up back in this situation again in 5 years or 10 years or perhaps just even a few years. First of all, we recall back in January 2013, Cameron in his Bloomberg speech said there would be an in-out referendum, but he was studiously vague at that time of to define in any detail what exactly he wanted. But he said he would outline it, and he wrote an article in March 2014 in the Sunday Telegraph outlining seven demands, as he described them, longer transition periods on the free movement of people for new member states, so that could be, for example, Serbia, curbs on social security benefits for EU migrants, I'll come back to that, a red card block on EU laws by national parliaments, deregulation in a single market and fairer, a faster free trade agreement, particularly thinking of the TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, an opt-out from the ever closer union phrase in the treaty, which is one of the red lines for some of his backbenchers, powers to flow away from Brussels. Now, I'm not quite sure really what that means, and an end to unnecessary interference from the European Court of Human Rights, which, of course, has nothing to do with the EU. That last point could be fixed by some UK Bill of Rights or what actually might end up just being an English Bill of Rights that doesn't apply in Scotland or Northern Ireland, but as is the nature of our growing, increasingly federal union that we have within the UK, that particular issue could potentially be taken off the agenda. Since then, he's outlined a few other various speeches, interviews, things he's said and written since then. I think people have added to that list some protection for the City of London, particularly financial services, and also preventing the Eurozone from caucusing against us. The idea that the Eurozone, through greater economic integration within the Eurozone, would be agreeing policies against us, which I can come back to. He then, by November 2014, after the rise of UKIP, particularly the success of UKIP in the European elections in May of 2014 and the rise of UKIP in the polls, and the rise of the immigration issue in all opinion polls as the prime, most salient issue that voters caring about, it seemed like all of the other issues he was discussing sort of eroded, and we were left with the idea this was all about immigration, this is all about free movement of people. And he made a speech on 20th of November 2014 where he set down a new list of demands related specifically to immigration. And I found this quite fascinating because a lot of what he said there was less than I expected him to ask for. For example, he said he wants to deport EU job seekers who've not found work within 6 months. So what? He wants 4 years before EU migrants have any access to in-work benefits or housing benefits. 4 years sounds like a long time, but access to just in-work benefits or housing benefits, that's actually less than what the Danes or the Dutch or some of the other Scandinavians or even some of the Germans in the CDU are talking about. Why? It's because, you know, Denmark is a very generous welfare state, and EU migrants in Denmark consume large amounts of benefits. EU migrants in Britain don't actually consume any benefits. It's a myth that they're sort of benefit scroungers. The only benefits they actually get are in-work benefits because they're all working. So the only benefits, having looked at the data, the only benefits that actually really go to EU migrants in the UK are in-work benefits, i.e. benefits paid to people below certain income, below certain salaries in employment, and housing benefit. And we have very generous housing benefits, and so they're the two areas of benefits. So the key question will come round to, I think, can he get a deal on restricting or limiting access to these two particular benefits, and I'll come back to that. Then he wants no free movement for new accession member states, which again I think many others would agree to, and making it easier to deport criminals, fraudsters and beggars, Romanians. What was conspicuous by its absence in these demands was any sort of emergency brake. People clamouring for the idea that if there's a certain volume of EU migrants into the UK in a given year, could the UK put a cap on this? And I think it was clear the other member states said that's absolutely in breach of the EU treaties, it's in breach of the fundamental principle of the free movement of people. There's no way anybody else would agree to that. Whereas I think there he was perceiving, I think he's right to perceive, that there is support for some limits on access to welfare benefits, but still allowing the free movement of people for people seeking jobs. So that comes to the question of how soon could he get it? And the key question here is, does it require treaty reform? Now, I know some lawyers have said restricting access to in-work benefits particularly could require treaty reform. I'm more of the view that this could be fudged or finagled in some way. There's already discussion that the Juncker Commission, Juncker will propose a reform of the 2004 Free Movement Directive. A lot of these rights for EU migrants are set out in a directive, which is secondary legislation, not the EU treaties. And so if that directive could be reformed, they'd have to start moving pretty quickly. I mean, a draft of the directive would have to come pretty soon and be proposed probably this autumn and be adopted pretty quickly through the Council and the European Parliament by next summer. I think there's support from a lot of the member states in northwestern Europe for changing the rights, access to benefits in that directive. Passing that directive would require a qualified majority vote amongst the governments and a simple majority in the European Parliament. I think he could get actually a simple majority in the European Parliament on this. There's over 150 MEPs in the European Parliament, at my last count, who I think would actually be in favour of this already. And there's growing splits within the EPP on the centre-right, with a lot of the centre-right parties in Europe under threat domestically from growing anti-European, anti-immigration movements like AfD in Germany, or the Sweden Democrats in Sweden, or the Front National in France, or you can go round most of northwestern Europe and come up True Finns in Finland. I think the centre-right parties in Europe would be sympathetic to changing the 2004 directive from the free movement of people toward in the direction that Britain wants, and perhaps even further than some of the things that Cameron has asked for thus far. The other option that has suddenly become very popular is what people are calling potentially the Danish solution, which, if you recall, back in 1992, there was a referendum in Denmark on the Maastricht Treaty that rejected the Maastricht Treaty. A new government was then elected. The government set down a set of demands that Denmark wanted. They couldn't reform the treaty they'd just signed, so there was an Edinburgh summit, and they agreed at the Edinburgh summit a set of opt-outs for Denmark, opt-outs from citizenship, the Justice and Home Affairs, defence, and the Eurozone. And the four particular opt-outs for Denmark, they were agreed in some special political declaration that then said these apply to Denmark generically. And then there was a second referendum in Denmark, and the referendum in Denmark was then more about the fact that there's a new deal, a new agreement for Denmark. Could there be a Danish solution of that type for the UK? Perhaps a particular UK protocol or UK declaration that says the ever closer union doesn't apply to the UK. That's pretty easy to say. It's largely, you know, cheap talk, doesn't mean anything. I think plenty of people were happy to say that. Some particular, it would be more difficult to define protecting the interests of the UK in the single market from caucusing in the Eurozone. It will be difficult to put into some UK protocol some special restrictions on the free movement of people. So the problem with the idea of the Danish solution is, for Denmark, these were unilateral things, giving Denmark a series of opt-outs. This time round, what Britain is asking for have implications on all the other member states. They're actually multilateral in their implications. Restricting free movement of people has implications on Danish, on Polish citizens and citizens from all the other East European member states who want to come to Britain. Having certain protections for the UK in the single market has implications for the other member states who are not in the Eurozone and might also be in a similar position. So it's much harder, I think, to agree some sort of special UK protocol. And at the end of the day, I think a lot of this doesn't really matter. I think whatever he brings home, there'll be right-wingers of the Conservative Party and UKIP, and all the 14% of the public who went out and voted for UKIP will be saying, this is just cheap talk, it doesn't mean anything, it's time we get out anyway. So actually, at the end of the day, I really don't think it matters what he gets. I think maybe at the margins. Ultimately, the argument is going to be one based on, you know, on economics, the economic interests of the UK. Are we better off in or are we better off out? One final quick comment, which is that if we do ultimately decide to stay in, what I hope is that we fundamentally change politically how we engage with the rest of the EU. Otherwise, we're going to end up in this position exactly the same again. I mean, we saw this with, for example, the Stop Juncker campaign, with the major political parties in the UK refusing to engage with the parties in the other EU member states in deciding how the Commission President is chosen. If we do vote to stay in, I hope the Conservatives decide to rejoin the EPP, and I hope that Labour decide to re-engage with the PES. It's the only way we're ever going to feel engaged with and part of mainstream EU politics. If our political leaders and our political elites refuse to do that, we'll be back here again in 5 or 10 years' time, and there'll be another referendum, and I bet you that one would be a vote to leave.
Well, Simon, thank you for a characteristically spirited intervention. Moving this along at a cracking pace. And it gives me great pleasure now to introduce our next speaker, John Springford, who is a Senior Research Fellow at the Centre for European Reform. John, amongst other things, has acted as Secretary to the CER's Commission on the Economic Consequences of Leaving the European Union, which published its final report just under a year ago, and he has built and displayed and shared great expertise on the economic dimension of a potential Brexit. And we're delighted he's come and joined us, our little LSE panel, this evening. But this is what I meant by the outreach to other expert partners, which will characterize, as you will see, our public engagement as an institution over the next 18 months or 2 years. Enough of that. John, please tell us, share some of your wisdom with us, especially on the economic issues, but not by any means exclusively, because I know you're looking at a whole range of asks.
Yeah.
Which Simon has touched on already.
Well, thank you very much, Morrison. It's a pleasure to be here. I have two slightly nervous announcements to make. One is that I only had six areas, unlike Simon's seven. But then I realised that Simon was including the ECHR in his list of seven, so then I went, phew. And then the second slightly nervous point is that I also wanted to go through the six asks which David Cameron was suggesting. But what might be helpful, I guess, for the audience is if I just pick some of them where I disagree with Simon, and then maybe just talk a little bit about some of the options for Britain if Britain decides to vote to leave the EU, and to have a think about whether they're any better than the current arrangements. So to just kick off quickly, I mean, let's have a quick comment on the strategy. As you know, Cameron wants to renegotiate Britain's relationship, have some reforms, and then have a referendum. But of course, this requires the other EU member states to agree. And at the moment, Britain's on a bit of a sticky wicket. It's not really very loved in the rest of the EU. There's a sense in many countries that reform is being forced upon them at the barrel of a gun. There's also a sense that reform is the strategy is largely being driven by Cameron's Eurosceptic right, and I think many of us would disagree with that, but that's certainly the sense in an awful lot of European capitals. And finally, Cameron hasn't really campaigned for staying in. He did a little bit in the Bloomberg speech, which Simon mentioned. But since then, he really hasn't made the case for the EU, which has upset a lot of other governments. And in terms of what the other member states, their stance is, they do not want Britain to be able to unpick the core fundamental principles of the single market. They're happy about, as Simon mentioned, there being some opt-outs, or if there must be treaty change, that these treaty changes are not necessarily going to cut across their own interests. But they're not happy about Britain just being able to do whatever it wants. And it's worth just considering what the single market is. It's essentially a grand bargain. And if the fear, particularly in Berlin, is if Britain is allowed to unpick bits of the single market, i.e. the free movement of labour, that it doesn't like, then other bits of the single market are going to get unpicked as well. From the Central and Eastern European side, then free movement is essentially the ability to be able to trade their labour by migrating. And the quid pro quo for that is that companies in Western Europe, which have lots of comparative advantages, can go and enter their markets. And I was in Hungary recently and was just astonished at the extent of the reach of Tesco in that country, which is something which Viktor Orban is trying to unpick, by the way. But that's basically the bargain. And if there's any sense that Britain is trying to unpick that bargain, then it's not going to happen. So Simon has mentioned the free movement aspect of that, and I think that's absolutely critical, because that's where Cameron is butting up against an attempt at unpicking. But it's worth just quickly running through a couple of the other reforms that he mentioned. So on safeguards for the single market, I mean, I think that the idea that the Eurozone is going to caucus somehow or gang up on the outs, I think, is a total red herring in most areas of the single market. The Eurozone as a whole, as measured by the OECD's product market regulation indicators, which sounds boring but is quite interesting if you dig into them, they are nearly as liberal as measured by the OECD as Britain is now, on average, Eurozone member states. So it's not as though, you know, it's a massive protectionist club that's trying to gang up on the British. But that's not necessarily true in financial services. And the ECB's recent location policy, where they've been trying to claw back euro-denominated clearing and trading, is one example where the interests of the Eurozone and that of Europe's largest financial centre, the City of London, may clash. But there's absolutely no chance that Britain is going to be given veto power over new financial services rules, which is something which the Fresh Start group, which is pretty influential in the Conservative Party, has been demanding. So one way out of this could, as you know, there could be a protocol saying that the single market is protected, but we're not going to see anything legal or very, very, very straightforward. On the national parliaments, I agree with Simon on the red card stuff. I mean, there is one way out of this, which is for the Commission to say that it's going to treat yellow cards. Currently, national parliaments can club together to demand that the Commission reconsider a proposal. And this has happened once or twice, and the Commission has said, well, we've reconsidered and we're going ahead. So what the Commission could do to give Cameron a bit of wriggle room on this is to say, well, we'll treat all future yellow cards as red ones. On powers flowing back to national parliaments, this can already happen under the Lisbon Treaty, but it requires the member states to agree. Seeing as the balance of competences review, the British government's own review of whether the competences are right between Brussels and London, found that there weren't really any competences that it thought should move. It's going to be pretty difficult to persuade the other member states that that's necessary. Ever closer union, Simon's covered. On extending free trade agreements in the single market, that's already underway. It's difficult to know how the mechanism by which Cameron can turbocharge them, which was the phrase that he used, seeing as external trade is an exclusive EU competence. But on the single market, on the internal market, then there are lots of things that Cameron can do, but it would require him to accept, if he wants services integration, for example, it would require him to accept that there is more control over regulation in the centre, in Brussels, because that's how markets are generally integrated in the EU. But it seems to me that there are some things which the Commission can do. Frans Timmermans, who is in charge of the Better Regulation Agenda, can say, OK, we're going to take some of Cameron's business task force reforms, which were announced last year, and take the good ones and say that, well done, Cameron, we have enacted those. But it's on the 6th, on benefits, that real trouble awaits. And it's here, I think, that I disagree slightly with what Simon was saying. Because I think that actually reforming access to in-work benefits is going to be very difficult. And that's because of the way that the UK's benefit system works. So just to quickly go back to the text of the Treaty on the Functioning of the EU, Article 45, hang with me for 1 second. It says that there can be no discrimination as regards employment, remuneration, or other conditions of employment. And the question is whether in-work benefits, which after all subsidise employment, should be considered as such. And if you have a dig around in the labour force survey and actually find out how Central and Eastern European migrants use these benefits, then it's pretty clear that they do really count as remuneration or other conditions of employment, and that if you took them away from them, then it would be discriminatory. So if you look at the average Central and Eastern European migrant, he's male, he's got one child, he's cohabiting, he works full-time, he has household earnings of about 60% of the British median, and he lives in low-cost housing, and the majority of people are in the southeast. And so that means that his median weekly earnings are about 265 quid a week, which is barely enough really to cover bills, rent and council tax. And under the new universal credit, which the government is rolling out over the next 5 years, that income will be topped up by £305 a week, so it will be more than doubled. So, you know, British people may consider it to be a fair outcome if, you know, these benefits are taken away from migrants. But the legal test, it's not a fairness test, it's a legal test, is whether that's discrimination. And it seems to me that it must be, because if the equivalent British worker is going to be more than twice as well off as a new migrant from Central and Eastern Europe, then they're going to be much more willing to supply their labour to do these jobs, which is going to be strongly against the fundamental principles of free movement, I think. So that, I think it's in that area of in-work benefits that we're going to see the most difficulty. It might be possible to have a fudge in the European Parliament, but it seems to me that if Cameron really wants to make this reform completely future-proof, then he's going to need treaty change. I'll just close with just a few remarks on the possible alternative arrangements should Britain vote to leave. As Maurice mentioned, we set up a commission which involved various economists and figures from business to try and have a think through the economic consequences of Brexit. And they included the FT's Martin Wolf and the LSE's own Paul de Croix and UCL's Wendy Carlin, amongst others. And we found that we set ourselves two questions. The first question was, has the single market been good for Britain? Because it's a good idea to know whether, you know, the thing that you're in is worth having or not. And then the second one is whether the alternative arrangements which might be available upon Brexit are good for you or not, are better or worse than the current arrangements. And on, so we broke this down into three areas, basically. And we set up a little model to try and test whether Britain trades more with the rest of the EU than one might expect, given the economic characteristics of Britain and its partners, you know, how close they are, how rich they are, and so on. And we found that Britain's trade with the EU is 55% higher than one would expect, given those characteristics. So there's a pretty big trade impact of being a member of the single market. Similarly, on investment, in 97, the other EU member states accounted for about 30% of the total foreign direct investment stock in Britain. And that rose to 50% by 2012-2013. On migration, we found that we used a lot of the evidence which others had put together, particularly Christian Dustman at UCL, who has found that migrants from elsewhere in the EU are big net contributors to the EU, to the UK budget, which should put the whole flap over EU migrants' benefits in some sort of relief. And that migration broadly is pretty beneficial for labour markets because it makes them more flexible, it gives employers a ready pool of labour, and there's no evidence really that increased migration, even from relatively poor countries in the EU, has had much effect on Britain's wages, and certainly not in the long term. So, in terms of the alternatives, they all seem to me to be pretty poor in a lot of ways. So one alternative is the EEA, the European Economic Area, which is the Norwegian option, as it's so called. This basically gives Norway full access to the single market, but Norway has virtually no say over the rules which govern the single market. And for a country which is so concerned about sovereignty as Britain, this seems to me to be a pretty poor outcome. The Swiss arrangement is another model which people talk about. The Swiss have a web of bilateral treaties which mostly cover trading goods. It doesn't cover trade in financial services, which would be pretty bad for the City of London, considering the City of London is the EU's preeminent financial centre. The Swiss, in exchange for having this web of bilateral treaties, have to accept free movement, which, again, for Britain, which is a bit neuralgic about immigration, doesn't seem to be a particularly good offer. And it seems as though any kind of free trade agreement which Britain might sign would require it to sign up to all of the standards in goods in particular. It's going to be very difficult to be able to get an agreement on services, which will be damaging for the city. And the quid pro quo for even a free trade agreement will almost certainly be that it accepts free movement of labour. So it seemed to us that seeing as membership of the single market had been largely beneficial and that the alternatives were worse, then it seemed not particularly sensible to leave it. Thanks, I'll leave it there.
John, thank you very much indeed. Thank you for some lots of really crunchy and telling points for us to mull over. Now, I'm going to open things straight away to the floor. I'm sure in the course of discussion, colleagues on the partners on the platform will be able to comment on points that other members of the platform make. But because I just want to open things up now as quickly as possible, propose to take questions three at a time and we'll invite panel members to answer which ones that they like. But given that format, which I think is probably the most efficient one, please keep your questions short. You're bored of being told that by chairs, but it is absolutely essential to keep them short and sweet, and say who you are, wait for the roving mic to come round please say who you are, tell us what your affiliation is, and we'll get cracking. So who would like to kick off? John Palmer's caught my attention. There's a, yeah, just coming.
Yes, thank you very much. Very helpful summaries of the situation. My question may be directed, well, it's directed to everybody, maybe primarily Simon, I'm not sure. And that is, there has been some talk that various commitments that might affect the treaty wouldn't be agreed in terms of amendments now, but some kind of legal commitment to reintroduce when a further treaty comes up, i.e., I'm not quite sure what guarantee that would really mean in practice, whether there's been any research on anticipatory forms of legal change to the treaty. That's the first question, whether anybody has got anything on that. And the second question concerning the possible changes to welfare, I mean, I must say from discussions I've had recently with people in certainly in Germany and in one or two other countries, they anticipate that this will raise very difficult questions with client partners in Central and Eastern Europe.
Thank you, John. Yes, another question, please. Who else would like to ask? Yes, the lady at the back. Yes, please.
Hello. This evening you set out very rational arguments around our membership of Europe. Bear in mind what we've just experienced over the election campaign. How much do you think it's going to be a rational debate in our media?
Thanks very much. And take one more now. And Quentin Peel caught my eye. So,
thanks very much. Quentin Peel, FT and Chatham House. Just two thoughts. I wonder if I could ask Sarah to remind us of the Danish referendum on the euro, which was a very interesting case of almost the entire establishment of Denmark, trade unions, employers, media, all the main political parties, all campaigning one way and the vote went the other way. And it would be quite an interesting one to put into British context. And I'd just like to ask any of you to... I'm baffled. We keep being told that this is about renegotiating the terms of British membership. Is there a single thing that is being asked for that has anything to do with renegotiating the terms of British membership?
Good. Thank you very much. Panel members, Sarah, would you like to engage with any of those? If not,
well, the last point first. So in 2000, the Danes voted, so there was an opt-out, as Simon Hicks has explained, in 92, which was voted on in 93, so the Danes had an opt-out from the euro. Now, this was never the political establishment, never wanted Denmark to be outside the euro. So at the first opportunity when the polls, and this is a good lesson, the polls looked like the Danes would definitely vote to join the euro, and this is a country that has its currency pegged, and whenever interest rate changes in Frankfurt, they change in Denmark. So it doesn't really involve a lot of actual economic autonomy. So when that question, when the polls looked like they were in the right direction, immediately they said, well, let's call this referendum and let's get it over with so we can finally join this thing. Everyone in the Danish parliament, except the very radical left and the radical right, campaigned to join the business community, the trade unions, everyone exactly as they, and it was defeated. Now, firstly, it was not just about the euro, it's about do we want this big political nasty union? No, we don't. We want Denmark to be a sovereign country. So it's, you don't always get the answer to the question you want. And secondly, Danes weren't persuaded that it would be the end of the world economically. So this is this thing, can you paint this scenario where, and this, but the difference with this one is that, you know, they were not campaigning to get rid of status quo. And this is why I say that the advantage of the insight comparison to that, that the insight has in the British referendum is this, the status quo bias, that the Brits by voting to leave, would have to change status quo, whereas the Danes were just saying, we just continue as we are, and we seem to be okay. So in that sense, the yes side had to say, well, if you don't say yes, it will be even worse, or somehow. So I think that's the difference, but certainly it does show that you can have a very massive campaign of all the political and economic elites, and you can still lose out.
Thank you very much, Sarah.
A couple of points related to several of those things. Firstly, on John Palmer's question about protocols then attached to the treaty, my understanding is that's exactly how it worked in the Danish example. But and all those arguments about it's impossible to come up with, and at face value right now, any UK exclusion of granting in-work benefits to EU nationals in the UK would be against Article 45. My general view of these things is the EU can be unbelievably creative at finding solutions. Never underestimate the ability of the EU to find a way to muddle through, would be a kind of mantra if you want to understand how the EU works. And so with that in mind, there'll be some clever lawyers somewhere in the council who figure out some kind of way to categorise these benefits as something different from in-work benefits. As long as under British law they could be called something different, there could be a way around it. So some of the legal constraints or legal arguments we've had up to now, I think, might not wash at the end of the day. They'll find some creative solutions to allow him to claim he has a new relationship. Maybe you can comment on whether you think he would be changing the terms of our relationship. On the emotional arguments, that's of course right, and I would reiterate the point that Sarah made, in that we might look at the opinion polls now, that cannot possibly be a predictor of what actually might happen when we have the referendum, perhaps even in October 2016. And another example, not just the Danish Euro example, was the Dutch referendum on the constitutional treaty. Almost all of the political parties in the Netherlands, and by far the most well-funded campaigns, were all on the vote yes side, and the public just went out and voted enormously no against all the leadership. But it was a chance the public kind of, yes, you've taken us for granted for so long, and we want our voice heard. I agree with Sarah's point about it's not about the status quo, and people are risk averse. But in the context of the UK, there's also a risk in staying in. I think the strongest argument of the let's get out now is Nigel Lawson's one, which is, given where the EU is heading, our choice right now is, are we going to be isolated inside the EU, or are we going to be isolated outside the EU? So the choice is not the status quo. They will try and frame it around the idea that, no, this is not the status quo. The EU is changing. The EU is integrating. It's going to be a federal Eurozone within the Eurozone, and we'll be outside that. So we'll be isolated whether we're inside or outside. So, wouldn't it be better for us to be free outside? So I think we can definitely, I could definitely think about ways to frame this in a kind of emotionally sovereignty, we're free from the diktats from Brussels, and, Yeah, I really worry about this being nothing to do with rational economic or legal or anything sensible. And bear in mind that for a lot of the rest of the country, it'll look like London telling them what to do. It'll look like, the financial interests and the City of London and big business and the chattering classes from Islington, Notting Hill and Putney telling them how to vote on whether we should be in Europe. For the rest of the UK, they'll be looking at them saying, well, what's the EU really done for me over the last 30 years? We've seen decline in industrial employment. There'll be a kind of anti-globalisation vote, and I think not just the people who vote UKIP, but a lot of Labour supporters actually will be putting pressure, and I can imagine that Labour will be split deeply on this issue as much as the Conservatives will. Particularly with the Conservatives in government, there'll be huge pressure within the Labour Party for them to come out and say, this is our chance to embarrass the Tories. Whether or not we stay in the EU will be irrelevant for large sections of the Labour Party, and they'll want to come out, they'll want to campaign against it. So my bet is there'll be a split within the Conservatives and a split within Labour, and it'll be pretty easy to frame this as a London elite, a London political and economic elite trying to tell us we're going to stay in, and then I really worry about a big backlash against that from an emotional point of view.
John, did you? In terms of John's question about changes to welfare and what this means for Germany, a lot of people, I think, don't realise quite how integrated the German economy is with Central and Eastern Europe, and how crucially important the countries that surround it are to its eastern flank, to its economy. There's been huge amounts of investment that have gone on in various different manufacturing sectors in Central and Eastern Europe from Germany. And it's also worth remembering that Germany is an aging population. Its working age population is declining. The government has made it pretty clear that it wants to have increased immigration, both from inside the EU and outside. And so the big question, I suppose, is Germany really in the let's stop migrants getting benefits camp or not? And as Merkel has been willing to throw Cameron under the bus in various ways, one of which was over Juncker's appointment, I wouldn't count on her not doing that again in this area. And just related on the question of Article 45 and the legal instruments, I bow to your better legal brain than me on this, but I suppose the question is there political will?
Yeah.
And, you know, Northwest Europe constitutes a large proportion of Europe's population and therefore commands a certain number of votes in the council. And the European Parliament may end up being in favour, but when I've spoken to some people in the European Parliament, they say that they don't want to do anything which has a bit of a rocky legal basis. So it will be pretty important, I think, that that they manage to make it pretty clear that this does not constitute discrimination under the treaties. On the rational arguments, I mean, it's a bit of a tricky one, this one. I mean, it seems to me that the most important thing is that it's going to be about which spokespeople are more believable. And I would put some money on, in fact, I'm going to put some money on Britain staying in. And the reason for that is that the spokespeople for staying in are likely to be the majority of the Labour Party. I think you're right, Simon, that there are going to be several people that decide to go out, but it'll be the majority of the Labour Party to stay in. The Liberal Democrats will stay in. I should have made them last. Sorry. The majority of the Conservative Party, I think, will stay in, and Morris can illuminate us more on that. And crucially, the SNP and the parties in Wales and Northern Ireland are going to stay in as well as the business community. And the people who are going to be voting to go out are precisely the members of the Conservative Party which caused that party to drag behind his leader in the opinion polls. So it seems to me that the spokespeople for staying in are likely to win out in that one. And then just very briefly on whether any of this is renegotiating terms of British membership. No, it isn't. And that's because Cameron realised in 2013 and 2014 that was just not on offer. And so he had a bit of a pivot towards trying to make it actually about reform, EU reform for the level of the 28, apart from some silly opt-outs about ever closer union. So it seems to me that the more that he does that, and particularly the more that he focuses on jobs and growth for the EU as a whole, the more likely he is to be able to persuade his partners. But the risk of that pivot is obvious, which is that his promise, which is he was going to deliver a renegotiated membership for Britain, is going to get harder and harder to achieve.
Right. I'm going to take another cluster of three questions. The lady at the front, John Pete, and the gentleman behind, yes, in the blue shirt.
I wanted to ask, we always speak of...
May I ask who you are?
Jesse Harrington. I wanted to ask whether... We always talk about immigrants into Britain. What about British migrants in Europe? How much benefit do we derive from that, or is that a negligible amount, please?
You have the data license. Mm-hmm. To me.
Yes, John.
Thank
Pete.
You very much. Yes, John.
Sorry, John Pete from The Economist. I'd be interested in any thoughts on parallels with 1975, and particularly in two respects. One, that I think the feeling in 1975 was that the continental European economy was doing much better than the British economy, and that was quite an important consideration in saying we ought to continue to be part of the club.
Whereas now, I think the thought, the thinking in Britain is that we are doing better than they are. And that might argue for more for an exit. And the other difference is that the press, which was referred to earlier, was overwhelmingly in favour of staying in 1975. It looks to me as if that's not going to be true this time around.
Thank you very much. Yes, the gentleman in the blue shirt. Yes. Yeah.
Lukas Appalzer, Government Department. In the run-up to the election, there's been a bit of a debate about who would be allowed to actually vote in the referendum, and I was wondering who you
think.
You
won't get a vote, Lukas.
I was wondering whether residents, whether you think residents will be allowed, or whether they should be allowed, and also under 18-year-olds.
Thank you. Okay.
Sarah. Just under 1975, I think you highlighted two important differences. I think there's a third one, and that is the degree to which people are willing to follow elite cues, or the deference, or the degree to which they think if the political and economic elites, or the political elites in particular, tell them that this is a good thing, then they follow them, and that has also changed a lot. If you look at trust in and respect for politicians, and that's why I slightly disagree with this view, or if only the more convincing spokespeople. I mean, it was clear in the campaigns that we referred to that the more convincing spokespeople were on the yes side, yet people sometimes really relish actually saying the opposite, having the opportunity. And just who will vote? I would think that it would be very similar to British general elections, so not on a residence basis, but it might be extended to 16 and 17-year-olds.
The other thing I'd say about 75, on the one hand, you could say, yes, the mainstream of politics, the mainstream, the business community, the trade unions will all be on the side of the yes. The other big difference is, what does Europe represent? So in 1975, Europe represented liberalisation of markets relative to a more regulated British state. So the right was in favour of Europe and the left was split. It's going to be the flip side this time round. It's going to be, you know, what is Europe? Europe, as you said, will be a dragon. Europe represents red tape, regulation, socialism through the back door kind of thing. And I think it's going to be very difficult for Cameron to hold together a party. I don't know what this means for members of the cabinet. I don't know. It's very easy right now to say Cameron has a mandate. He's won this election surprisingly. The party's well behind him. Once the campaign begins, that sort of broad coalition of the Conservative Party behind him really might start to break up. And I think the challenge was for Labour in 1975. I think the challenge is really for the Conservatives now. And I don't know how that changes the dynamics. The British migrants in other member states, I think it's around 2 million, so approximately the same number of migrants in the UK from other EU member states, EU migrants abroad. I think, was it... you guys can probably speak about it, but there was a piece of research that showed that the total volume of benefits consumed by EU migrants in the UK just pales in insignificance compared to the volume of benefits British migrants get in other EU member states. For example, healthcare in Spain for all their pensioners over there.
Yeah, well, no, that's absolutely right. I mean, the way the benefits work, particularly for healthcare. So about 40% of those 2 million are retired, and they're all in Spain, France and Italy, basically, having a very jolly time. But the way it works is the host member state has to pay for GP appointments, which is pretty expensive, actually, for a lot of old people, whereas hospital treatment, there's a system of transfers, although lots of health systems don't bother. But yeah, it's a pretty large healthcare bill. So there's a bit of British hypocrisy, I think, about migrants' benefits there. On the parallels with 1975, I mean, I think that's absolutely right. And I suppose one glimmer of hope is that the Eurozone seems to be on a bit of a cyclical upswing now. Whether that continues, who knows? But there's that seems to me to be an argument for trying to have an early referendum, if possible. I mean, the Eurozone, if and when the next downturn comes, has maxed out fiscal and monetary policy and doesn't have a great deal of wiggle room. So we can expect some pretty severe hand-wringing about further integration about the Eurozone at the next downturn. So I would hope that they would have the referendum, that Britain will have the referendum before that happens. And the voting stuff, I think, has been covered.
I think, well, one thing we haven't really got a sense of yet, I think, or risk underestimating, is the sheer political momentum that David Cameron will. I think this will play to his strength as a campaigner. He will, by definition, he will negotiate until such point as he feels that he's actually got a package that he can put to the British people. Axiomatically, he will only call a referendum at a moment when he feels he's got a package that he can sell. And will he get that package? Well, we've been going looking at itemising all the problematic issues and how one can maybe get a way through. But the key thing, clearly, is going to be whether Britain's partners really, really, really want to go the extra mile to keep Britain in. And of course, there are nice points to make about, well, there's even with sympathisers and allies, there's a point at which you can get them so annoyed that they might tell you just to go and take a run and jump. I think that is extremely unlikely. Because think of the alternative from the EU's point of view as a whole. Closer to the... We know all the things which diplomats traditionally say about what they like about the British, the pragmatism which the British bring to the EU, pragmatism which will probably cause them to lead them to vote with their pockets, I would suggest, actually, when crunch time comes. But the disposition towards free markets, which not just the northern countries, the famous Northern Coalition supports, actually, but the reforming premiers and more southern parties in more southern parts of Europe, which are increasingly signed up to a liberalising agenda. Even if they don't necessarily agree with every word of it, they're very keen that presence should remain there and should be play an important part. And to say nothing of the reluctance to having avoided, well, some, you can have an argument about whether there was an actual Franco-German directoire as such, but having avoided that directoire as such, then stumbling into a German directoire is something which I don't think any of Britain's partners are really, really, really prepared to entertain for a minute. And the one thing we do all lose sight of, is a more fundamental point, is what it would mean for the EU, what it would mean for that great, that noble project launched in the early 50s, enshrined in the Treaty of Rome, that it would have a cataclysmic effect. It would be an existential moment, almost of self-immolation. How would the rest of the world view a club that could not even keep as a member one of its own leading members? It would be a complete and utter disaster for Europe. And I think actually peering into the abyss, should it come to that point, that even those mightily fed up with Britain's negotiating style say, look, there's something much bigger at stake here. Let's not be petulant. So whilst I wouldn't say that it is a safe operative assumption to assume 100% that we can get what we want, but Cameron will get pretty much what he wants, and he'll throw his all into getting it adopted, endorsed by the British people. And the momentum will be with him.
You might be right, but I've not heard anything like that in Brussels or Paris or Rome, or last week I was in Madrid. I've not heard anything like that from anywhere I've been talking to policymakers. And I give you some examples. So, the general view is this is a British problem. Why should we fix Britain's problem? Your elite have got yourself into this mess. You've refused to kind of educate your public about Europe, and now you're asking us to fix a problem that's your problem. So primarily you have to fix this problem. We can help you at the margins, but ultimately, if the British people don't want to be part of this, we'd rather know now and you get out. And that is even from a mainstream centre-right. If you move anywhere left from there, there's growing view that actually, and the narrative amongst the German SPD and the French socialists is, well, it's the Anglo-Saxon bankers that caused the crisis. If they want to leave, then so what? That's the sort of thing that I think it really is hamstrung Merkel. Merkel all the way along, as we heard here, the assumption from London has been, well, of course, Merkel, who behind the scenes says this to Cameron, of course, and hence Cameron assumes he's going to get a deal from Merkel on the fiscal compact treaty, which, of course, he didn't. On Juncker, which of course he didn't. And so why does he think he's going to get one now? The deep hostility, I think, to the British Conservatives among the mainstream centre right across Europe, part of it coming from the fact that they left the EPP group in the European Parliament. Which in Britain, you might think that's completely irrelevant. But in fact, that's really relevant for the Scandinavian centre-right, the East European centre-right. They thought that they were going to build a kind of Anglo-Scandic East European centre-right bloc within the EPP that would counterbalance the CDU and the UMP in France. And they had it all calculated, they would do this, and by, you know, 5-6 years ago, they would be able to dominate this group. He pulls out. The two people most upset with him are Reinfeldt and Tusk. Tusk is then pushed into the arms of Merkel. Reinfeldt was then furious. And so he's not really got allies across Europe. I mean, this is the real problem for him now. He's now going, saying, we need these things, and everyone's doing what we used to do. They're going, blah, 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 we don't want to listen to you, go away. Please just solve the problem yourself. Go and have your referendum and vote to decide to stay in or leave. That's what I fear.
There's angry moments in every family, but family tends to stick. Families, we get very sensitive about it, but families tend to stick together. The costs of not are massive, and I don't think we should underestimate that. Right. No,
anyway,
sorry, John.
More
John.
Well, on that particular issue, where
or
I stand in
the last three questions, because I'd like to take another three questions.
Well, should we take some more questions?
Yes, okay. Who else would like to ask a question now? Yes, gentleman. Yes, with a beard and his hand up.
That's
lots of hairs running.
My name is Jonathan List. I used to work for a couple of years in the European Parliament for a self-proclaimed Euro-realist MEP. You can guess the party perhaps. I have a couple of points. First of all, about Norway. I think that Norway should take an enormous role in this upcoming campaign. On both sides, I'm sure it will, but we can also look at the Norway referendum in 1994, in which 52% voted no. Oslo was 67% in favour, which backs up your point about the city against the regions. And of course, the elites have always been in favour of EU membership in Norway. Obviously, the Prime Minister Gro Harlem Brundtland was, Jens Stoltenberg was, and Anna Solberg, the current Prime Minister, is, and it changes nothing, because Norway is not budging. And I know lots of Norwegians who live in Brussels who lament this problem on a daily basis. In terms of our referendum, one thing that hasn't been discussed is the constitutional element if England votes to go out and the other nations stay, because Nicola Sturgeon certainly won't have that, and that will lead to Scotland going pretty soon afterwards, I shouldn't think. And also, there's already speculation about the referendum perhaps coming in May 2016, which sort of gives the lie to this 20th sense that it's about a renegotiation. If you're prepared to name a date before you've even started negotiations or discussions, and that is obviously not going to be about renegotiations at all. And very last point, very quickly, in response to what you said, John, about a quid pro quo for a free trade agreement being freedom of movement. You speak to a lot of UKIP MEPs in Brussels who say that German companies will do anything to be able to sell their goods to British consumers, and that that they'll be prepared to accept anything. So, is it a question of who will blink first? And that actually Britain can get its free trade without having to squander.
Thank you very much. We must move on. Yes, right at the back in the corner. I'll take one more after that, and hopefully there'll be time for just one more round after that. Yes.
Guy Falconbridge, Reuters. I just wondered how you think, given the importance of the campaign to the Brexit referendum, how you think the best way would be to sell European Union membership to a rather sceptical British public? Thank you.
Okay, and the third question, yes, somebody who didn't have done, sorry. Somebody else had indicated, had their hand up, but if you've given up, yes, it was you.
Hi there, Jack Harvey, student of the University of Bath. I lowered my hand because the gentleman behind me had already more or less stated my point. My point was going to be what was going to be the ramification of a no vote with regards to Scottish nationalism.
Okay.
Just want to show one slide. There's a lot is made up, so it's relevant to the question. Yeah, a lot is made up. Oh, the Scots are so different. The people who are really different, that's also the point made about Oslo, those in London, so the people should really be calling for an independence referendum if Britain decides to exit.
Yeah,
yeah, the Scots are a bit more pro, but to the questions made, I think this is clearly an excellent opportunity if Britain does decide to exit, I mean, this is clearly an excellent opportunity for the SNP to then say, then, now something has changed. We need, the Scots have not agreed to this, we need a referendum on independence. And I think there would be not unlikely to get it, but I think it is noteworthy that a lot is made of Scotland, the Scots being so pro-European compared to the English, and I don't think there's that much evidence of that. However, there is a lot of evidence that people in London are more pro-European than the rest. It might be because we're all bankers, but how to win it, just one point on that, I think how to win it is to not make it about the renegotiations of what you get and not make it about membership and the uncertainty and the risk associated with leaving, and that leaving really means leaving, not, oh, we get a slightly better point. Because if people can be persuaded that you get a slightly better deal from Europe if you leave, then they'll probably take that deal.
Okay. Is there anything else you wanted to make? Yes.
Quickly on Norway or not. The selling the membership thing, I think the Scottish referendum is quite interesting here. So the independence argument had all the emotional side of the, you know, Scottish independence and sovereignty and freedom and all the rest of it. The no side was more of the risk averse. This could be very scary. And what was interesting at the end of the day was looking at the polls afterwards, which groups in society looked like they changed at the last minute. And it was older voters and older women voters from lower income groups who voted overwhelmingly to stay in the union. And I think they responded very much to the financial risks argument. And I think similar things could happen. There'll be certain groups in society that will be very focused on the financial risk. It's better the devil you know than the devil you don't. And certain groups in society who quite rightly and quite rationally will worry about potential financial costs of us leaving. And that could, at the end of the day, with some of the key groups, be absolutely critical. On Norway, I mean, you know, I think the Norway, a lot of people discussing the Norway as an option. There was an interesting report from the Foreign Affairs Committee in the House of Commons, I think in 2012, or 2013, beginning spring of 2013, that looked at options for Britain in Europe, and they considered the Swiss and the Norwegian options, and they even went over to Oslo to talk to the Foreign Affairs Committee in the Oslo Parliament, and they reported on what they said, and they said to them, do not leave. I mean, it's quite telling that the Norwegians said, well, we basically have to implement the whole of the acquis communautaire, we have to accept free movement of people, and we don't get any say over this. In a sense, we are Puerto Rico. We are a commonwealth of the EU. And I don't think that is really what UKIPers want. So I don't think that seriously is going to be considered as an option. I think the Swiss option or some version of it could be possible, but then there's some fantasy that because we're big and powerful, we'll be able to get good deals with the rest of the EU. Well, no, actually, Switzerland gets pretty good deals because on average, the cost of labour is higher, their social standards are higher, their environmental standards are higher. In fact, it's much more difficult for Britain because it would be seen by the rest of the continent that we would be undercutting the rest of the EU in any kind of free bilateral agreements we have. And by the way, Switzerland, there's real reluctance in Brussels to give Switzerland any more bilateral agreements. They've asked for a whole bunch of new ones. The Commission is basically going to say no, because what they fear, what I hear from inside the Commission, is if we give Switzerland any more bilateral agreements, Austria will say, actually, we might leave and go for the Swiss option too. So I think one thing I do agree with Maurice, that the real concern for some of the others is this could potentially be a slippery slope. If Britain leaves, is there a domino effect? What about Hungary? What about Austria? What about Czech Republic? What about some of the other places that are also quite Eurosceptic?
Just two quick points. On the deficit surplus argument, so, you know, Britain's Eurosceptics are fond of saying, well, they sell a lot more to us than we do to them because, you know, they've got a big trade surplus with Britain, whereas we've got a big trade deficit with them, which is an argument that has some force. And I don't think we should necessarily see this as a total sort of game theoretic calculation. But actually, I think the relevant calculation here is on the part of an individual member state. It's not about the EU as a whole. So because individual member states, if Britain votes to leave, are going to be deciding, you know, whether they're going to support giving Britain a nice deal after they've just voted to leave the club. And their calculation is different to that. So Britain basically exports 45% of its exports to the EU, whereas the average EU member state only exports 7% of its exports to Britain. So there's a big difference. Britain is in a much more supplicatory position really than the other member states when it comes to negotiating a free trade agreement. And then lastly, on the ramifications of the Scottish referendum, I think it's worth just thinking about young people and old people. So, you know, there was a young people surge for the SNP because of the emotional arguments. Older people tended to break the in. And that's completely reversed in the EU polling. So older people tend to be more anti, and younger people tend to be much more pro. And my fear, I guess, is that that young people are fickle voters. And getting them out will be crucial for the inside to be able to win.
The core of the message has to be for the camp for staying in, surely has to have, the word together has to be in there, because I think the sense, not for some sort of quaint sentimental or romantic reason, but I think people do have a sharper sense, perhaps than ever, and certainly in my lifetime, of interdependence and vulnerability of states on their own. It's cold out there. It's scary out there, and both in the context of economics, the idea of better off together, which is that the core concept which the Yes embryonic Yes campaign, well, not no longer embryonic, actually, it's been actually gestating for the last 2-3 years, but this idea of better off together, I'm not bringing spilling any beans or breaking any trade secrets by saying that this better off together will be at the very heart of that sort of message. And also, I might add, safer together. This is the world of Vladimir Putin with the Islamic army. It's an interesting point. One of the reasons given, and maybe Sarah has seen some more intensive research than I have seen, but in the speculation as to why support for the EU appears to have gone up in this country, may have something to do with people seeing these enormities being committed not that far from the EU, whether in the Levant or a bit further into the Middle East, or whether courtesy of Mr. Putin. The world is looking like a very scary, unstable place. And one might anticipate, or one can certainly, if you're in the Yes camp, play on that huddling together, that security and comfort to be derived from working with people who are not a million miles from one's own stripe and background and values.
Can I add one thing to that, which is I agree with that in the following sense. What was amazing a few weeks ago was with the boat crisis in the Mediterranean. Within the space of 48 hours, the complete reversal of the British position across the political spectrum, and all of the newspaper editors all were saying, we need the EU to do more. Now, you know, from having 2 weeks of a few days previously saying, no, the EU should have nothing to do with this, they're all now clamouring for the EU to do more under huge pressure from the public and pressure from the newspaper. So kind of the fickleness of the British public and the media on questions to do with Europe suggests that things could change pretty rapidly.
But all the media said we're not taking any more refugees. I mean, that was the message. Yeah, the EU needs to do something, but we are certainly not doing any burden sharing. I mean, that's why the whole together thing. And I mean, that's not just Britain. I mean, if you read Danish newspapers, they were all like, don't worry, we haven't upped that. We're not taking any. I mean, so it's not just, that's not a sort of only British thing, this sort of feeling that, yes, I mean, the EU should sort it out. But so I think the idea, I mean, if I was campaign manager, I don't think I would play in a together cup, because I don't think Britain feel that, you know, most British people have that kind of emotional attachment that they might have to the Union, that we are together in something. It needs to be a better deal for Britain and for the British.
Questions?
Yes. Okay, we'll take 3 more questions. Yes, the gentleman there has been quite tenacious and must be rewarded for his tenacity. I think. Anyone on this side? I'm just trying to pick up in advance who I was thinking. Yes, the lady there, and the lady there. Yes, please.
Hi, Christopher Brat here, a PhD student at the European Institute. I was just wondering about one thing that was like mentioned, but not really. You didn't really get into this, and this is I think one of the huge differences from my perspective to all the other referendums on European integration we had is that the party system will be much less in favor. We will have no very strong supporters, united parties that say, okay, we want to stay in, but the major parties will be split to some extent, and we know if parties are split, then queues do not work as well. Some parties will, like UKIP, will basically have a strong campaign for staying out. And I think compared to any other referendum we have seen, the party system is in a much less good shape to win this referendum. And I was just wondering, what do you think will this make to the odds?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Thank you. We will, I'm sure, want to come back to it. Yes, there's a lady here in the black shirt.
Hi, Hannah Lamont-Defra. I just querying the statement around how the EU and Britain deal with the legal side of things. It seems to me to be that Britain takes a much more black and white approach than other member states do to the law and regulations of the EU. I wonder whether you, A, agree with that, and B, whether there's a case for actually not necessarily renegotiating our terms as such, but re-looking at how we work with the EU and how seriously we take some of the regulations that are in place compared to other member states.
Thank you very much. Yes, and there's the lady.
I think it's me. Hello, Agata Kosnitska from the Center for European Reform. I have half a comment, half a question. I must say that I'm very astonished by the Eurosceptics who think that, or think, first of all, that UK would be better off outside the EU, and they think that it could just come over the day. It's just we decide to leave, and let's make this assumption. We decide to leave, and then EU leaves just over a day. And I have the impression that it will be very time-consuming and very difficult negotiating process, because withdrawing is also about renegotiating. And this is actually what John already mentioned. And we don't have many case studies. It's only Greenland that it's a slightly different case. And it also took a while, actually, to renegotiate the relationship between this autonomous region and the EU. My question would be to Simon, could you please use your imagination and sketch how this withdrawal process could look like? Because the treaties, well, they provide a certain framework, as we know, but it can go either way. So I'd be very grateful for your thoughts.
Thank you.
Just on the first question on whether or not this is unique. So certainly it's unusual that the political elites are so Eurosceptic, although it looks like the party leaderships of the three major parties, or the two major parties, will campaign in favor. However, it's the Maltese referendum on membership, the elites were entirely split. You know, there's a two-party system. One was for, one was against. The Danish Single European Act referendum, the socialist, social democrats campaigned against. So, you know, it's not that unique. But one thing I'll say, and touches on that point, that a lot have been talked about, that it was sort of the conservatives that have to persuade their voters and they will be swinging. I think it's the Labour voters who will swing. And that's what we've seen in all EU referendums, that the voters, although the party might be less split, the voters, because they're generally the more economically vulnerable, the ones who are more Eurosceptic, I think many of them will vote to leave. And so what we used to see in these referendums, that is the extent to which the social democratic or Labour parties can persuade their voters, that will determine it rather than the centre-right.
So this is seen very much as Cameron's referendum.
Yes, that's a real danger, because while he might have won, you know, he won 37%, and there are a lot of people who are, you know, very unhappy with another Cameron term, and if they see this as an opportunity to get back at him, so in that sense it might be good that the Tories are split.
So two related points. One on the law, Britain's attitude towards EU law. It's a British misconception, in a way. When you look at the implementation records of the single market, Britain is mid-table. It was perhaps true 10, 15 years ago that Britain had a particular view of EU regulations that wasn't shared by other member states, but I don't think that's the case anymore. And I think there's the gold plating of EU regulations in the UK has is not as extreme as it was in the past. So I'm not, it's not quite true to think that we have a different view of the way EU law works as compared to the other member states. On the issue of, you know, the case to leave, you know, having said one mantra about the EU, never underestimate the ability to use muddle through, one mantra about the UK, never underestimate British arrogance. you know, the assumption that they're going to be falling over themselves to give us everything we want, and if they don't, we'll be fine out there in the world because we're a superpower. You know, there isn't this conception it's a big, scary world. We sit on the Security Council, for goodness sake, and we have Trident, and everybody takes us seriously, and everyone looks at us as the as a world leader on X, Y, and Z. I mean, that's generally the attitude of the political establishment in the UK, and I think why we've fallen foul so many times in negotiating in Brussels. But that would be the case against the people who are arguing that we can't possibly leave because it's safe inside the warm, cuddly club of the EU. The allegation against them is, you're obviously anti-British because you think that we haven't got the confidence to stand on our own out there in the world. We are the world capital. London is the capital of the world, and we have the world's financial system here, and we are the centre of the global creative industries, and blah, blah, blah. That will be the mantra going on the wanting to leave side. And I don't think there'll be much of the discussions about what kind of deal can we get to stay in the single market. If we did vote to leave, I really wouldn't want to speculate what happens then. I think it will come down to what kind of access will we get in terms of bilateral access to the single market, and it will be very difficult for financial services. My guess right now is we'll vote to stay, but it'll be narrower than we perhaps think right now, and I don't think it'll be off the table. I think we're in a changed political landscape in the UK, which means that the public demanding almost regular say on fundamental constitutional questions. And the Scottish referendum, which we assumed means it's resolved for a generation. No, it's not. It's resolved for about 5 years, and it'll be back on the table. It could be well again the situation, particularly if it's quite close, and particularly if then things change again in the Eurozone, whether deeper European Eurozone integration or Brexit from the Eurozone or any fundamental change to the structure of the Eurozone could again raise the question of now it's time. It wasn't right for us to leave back then, but now it is the right time for us to leave. So I think we could be in for a rocky ride for quite some time.
Now, LSE protocol and good manners require us to give the last word to our guest. John Springford from the CER. John, would you like to share any final thoughts with us? Because yeah. Sadly, I'll have to draw things to a close.
Well, okay. I mean, just to respond to those points, I mean, I think it's an excellent question about the fact that we don't have united parties. My one question about it, though, would be, will parties be absolutely crucial to this process? Because you can see there being a fight over the EU referendum bill in some ways. So the Scottish National Party, for example, is going to make as much hay as it possibly can over it. But I'm not sure that it's really in Labour's interest to pull a Maastricht and try and make it really hard for Cameron, because they're very nervous about being on the wrong side of public opinion about the referendum bill and the fact that there needs to be a referendum. And Andy Burnham, for example, and I think Yvette Cooper too, will probably try and discourage that kind of thing. On the ECHR, you know, there could be some rebels on the Conservative side. There will be, I think, if they try and pull Britain out of the convention altogether. But when it comes to the actual reform process itself, and then putting it to the British people, there's not that much role for Parliament, really, in the nitty-gritty of that process. It's going to be intergovernmental. On the law and regulations and whether Britain should just sort of unilaterally opt out by not putting them in properly, or I mean, that happens. There's all sorts of wrinkles that are put into the legislation. But as a political exercise, I think it's probably not a very sensible one, because particularly if you're going to do it in highly contentious areas like free movement, because you'll have cases brought against you at the ECJ, and so you'll actually deepen public Euroscepticism through that process, I think. And then lastly, on Agatha's point, I mean, who knows, but the one thing that I do know is that it's not only the single market and access that's going to have to be dealt with, You know, there's the free trade agreements which the EU has with lots of other countries, and they're going to have to be rewritten. And it's not clear that Britain, which is producing a declining share of world output, is going to be a hugely important partner for lots of countries outside the EU. So I'll leave it there.
Thank you very much, John. Well, it only remains for me to thank our panellists for what I think, and to you all, A, for coming, B, for the excellent questions that have been put. I think we've had really a tremendous hour and a half, actually, I may say so myself, not that I'm responsible for it, but we are all are collectively responsible for it, and particularly our panellists. So can I, in time-honoured LSE fashion, can I ask you please to show your appreciation to our panel. And please look out for the next events Britain and Europe, the next chapter series of events.